Well, good morning. Pretty good. Pretty good for sort of partway through week two. And just as well, you're having a change of speaker every week, isn't it? Gives you a bit of variety. And in fact, by the time you finish this particular school, you will have gone from Australia to the UK. And so that's probably quite a good experience to experience different speakers from different parts of the world, who therefore, to quote postmodernism, all come from entirely different cultures and yet can come to the Bible, despite their cultural bias, and expound the same absolute truths from Yahweh's word, because they have allowed God to speak to them rather than for them to fashion their own truths out of the text. Now, I've only got just sort of two or three overheads today, or slides today, but let me just see if I can find the one that... we've got one here that's a summary of yesterday's session. So, Yahweh Elohim, the Elohim of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. So let's just remind ourselves of what we got to yesterday. God entitles himself Yahweh Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, and the Elohim of Jacob. So remember, we discovered yesterday that this is a particular form of address, as it were, that God delights to be known as and called by. He calls himself that he is the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And you'll remember that in our session yesterday, we discovered that Yahweh's purpose to manifest himself, and we're going to come onto this manifestation idea a little bit more today, that Yahweh's purpose to manifest himself is revealed in the names and the lives of the three patriarchs. And thus he is pleased to be called he who will be manifested in the mighty ones of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Together these three form a prophecy of Yahweh's intention to be manifested as a father, Abraham, in a son, Isaac, and through a multitude, Jacob. And so you'll remember that we discovered yesterday how that these three patriarchs become a prophecy of the entire purpose of God in this respect. And notice that they're all slightly different. Yahweh manifested as a father, Yahweh manifested in a son, and Yahweh manifested through a multitude. And so they're all going to be slightly different, but together they will form the total of the Father's purpose and intention that he had from the beginning. These names, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were chosen to represent the memorial of his proposed manifestation in flesh, and to identify his selection of the family through whom such mighty ones of the future would be established. Not only would these three men be a prophecy of the intention of God, but the mighty ones that God intends to be revealed in would be the mighty ones of this family, the Elohim of this family. It was this family that would be the family through whom God would finally be revealed. So as our chairman has rightly said, what we're going to come on to today is the subject of Yahweh manifested as a father. So this is a focus, if you like, on God himself, but in this particular and special capacity as a father, expressive of his intentions. Now, I just want to start by saying this. So, by the way, that should be our centre of the mind map. Yahweh manifested as a father. So that's the circle in the middle of our mind map. We're going to grow it out from there in terms of what this might mean. Well, let me start by saying that Yahweh and Father are not interchangeable terms. Why do you think I say that, by the way? Why would that be important to know? What I mean by that is that they're not equivalent terms. The word Yahweh and the word Father are not the same, Yes?
Yahweh is not everyone's father.
That's right. Yahweh is ultimately not everyone's father. Correct. And also, Yahweh as the name of God is not equivalent to simply calling him Father. Now, the reason why I mention that is because there has been an argument advanced that in the New Testament, when it refers to the Father, is that this is the succession to the idea of Yahweh in the Old Testament. That Yahweh of the Old Testament is our Father in the New Testament. We're not saying that Yahweh is not a father, but the word Father is not, in fact, a successor term to the word Yahweh himself. And one of the reasons why I mention that is because if we come back to the Old Testament, it's absolutely clear that the idea of the fatherhood of Yahweh was taught in the Old Testament, long before the New Testament comes along. In fact, let me show you some of those by way of illustration. So, Old Testament teaching, if you like, concerning the fatherhood of God. Well, here's a couple of passages that use the imagery of a father concerning God. The first one is Proverbs chapter 3. So God is, if you like, imagined as a father without specifically saying that he is, but he's described in terms that are representative of fatherhood. So Proverbs 3, for example, and verses 11 and 12 says, "My son, despise not the chastening of Yahweh, neither be weary of his correction. For whom Yahweh loveth, he correcteth, even as a father the son in whom he delighteth." God chastens like a father that loves his son. Now, you notice it doesn't actually say that God is a father of a son, but it's like a father who loves his son. God has the qualities of a father. Without at this stage, you couldn't prove from Proverbs 3 that God is the father of a son, or even of a family, but the imagery of the characteristics and qualities of a father are attributed to God in this passage. Whom Yahweh loveth, he correcteth, just like a father corrects the son in whom he delights. By the way, just as an aside, you might like to take that as a comforting thought, boys, if you go home and find that your father disciplines you. Proverbs 3 says it's a mark of his delight and love. We don't always think that when our fathers discipline us, but in fact the reason why a father disciplines a son is not to exact brutal revenge, not to manifest his violent anger, but because he loves his son and wants to make sure that he doesn't grow up with principles that will be detrimental to the son. So he corrects them along the way. It's a mark of love, says Proverbs, and God does it. So by the way, if God chastens, then the idea of disciplining children is a divine principle. I don't know, have you got an anti-smacking rule in Australia? An anti-smacking rule? Is it enshrined in legislation? Okay, we've got the same thing in New Zealand, and you know, you've got this, again, postmodernism gone mad. On the one side, you've got children being beaten to death and brought into hospital dead on arrival because they've been smashed beyond description at the age of two. And then because they're perhaps Maori or Aboriginal, there's all sorts of complications arise out of whether they can be prosecuted or what the cultural background was and what the tribal connections were and whether it's appropriate that it be dealt with in a European system. And on the other side, someone who disciplines their child in a supermarket with a smack because they pinched something off the shelf got reported for the police for violence to their child. It's nuts. Completely nuts. It's a world gone mad because it's abandoned the absolute truth of divine principles. Here's another one, Psalm 103. Now, Psalm 103 says the same sort of thing in the sense of God's attributes, as it were. Psalm 103 verses 12 and 13 says, or maybe 13 and 14, "Like as a father pitieth his children, so Yahweh pitieth them that fear him, for he knows our frame, he remembers that we are dust." So here what we're being told is that just on the one side, as Proverbs 3 says, that God's prepared to chasten his offspring, so on the other side, he loves them and pities them like a father pities his children and shows compassion towards them. So God has those attributes of both severity, Proverbs 3, and mercy and goodness, Psalm 103, just like a father has. But it's more than that, because if you come to Malachi chapter 2, we're told that in a more specific way, Malachi claims this concerning the creative power of God. He says in Malachi chapter 2 and verse 10, "Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother?" Have not we all one Father? Has not one created us, one God created us? So God is the creative source of all mankind, as described as the one Father from whom all springs. One Father who's created all things. Now, by the way, a good cross-reference to that in terms of New Testament teaching on the same subject is the 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 6, which you don't need to turn up, but I'll just quote to you. It says, "But to us there is but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him." 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 6. There's one God, the Father, out of whom are all things. Have we not one Father, says Malachi chapter 2? Has not one God created us all? So in a sense, you could say that God's the Father of all the world, because he's the creator of everything. So in that sense, he's the Father of every living thing. The whole of creation testifies to the Father's creative power. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, though, it's more specific again. Because in Deuteronomy chapter 32, in the words of Moses, as he composed and sang his final song to the nation before his imminent death, he says this in Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verses 5 and 6. He says, "They've corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They are a perverse and crooked generation. Do ye thus requite Yahweh, O foolish people and unwise? Is he not thy father that hath bought thee? Hath he not made thee and established thee?" Now, this is not being addressed to all creation, is it? This is being addressed to who? To the nation of Israel, redeemed out of Egypt. And Moses says to the nation that have been redeemed out of Egypt, that the father of the nation is Yahweh himself. He's our father, says Moses. He's made us because he's constituted us as a nation and bringing us out of Egypt into Sinai and joined us unto him. And again, if we come to the prophecy of Isaiah, chapters 63 and 64, we find that very idea set up by the prophet concerning the relationship of God to the nation of Israel, his people. Despite all of the varying vicissitudes of their life and their experience, this one thing the prophet declares concerning their relationship to God as a people, he says, Isaiah 63 verse 16, "Doubtless thou art our father, though Abraham be ignorant of us and Israel acknowledge us not, thou, O Yahweh, art our Father, our Redeemer, thy name is from everlasting." And again, in chapter 64 and verse 8, "But now, O Yahweh, thou art our Father, we are the clay, and thou our potter, and we all are the work of thy hand." Thou, O Yahweh, art our Father. Now, by the way, notice how that those two things are different. Thou, O Yahweh, art our Father. So Yahweh and Father are not the same term. If they were equivalent, Isaiah could have just said, "Thou art our Father." But he says, "Thou, O Yahweh, art our Father," which is the name of God and the fatherhood of God that springs out of that name. Now, just one final reference then concerning the Old Testament teaching on this, and that's the famous prayer of David at the time of the coronation of Solomon in the 1 Chronicles chapter 29. And That's exactly what David says. Perhaps he was taking up the spirit of Moses at the time. Perhaps the very prayer of David became the basis for the words of Isaiah, which would follow later on. Because in David's prayer, in the first of Chronicles chapter 29 and verse 10, it's going to say, "Wherefore David blessed Yahweh before all the congregation, and David said," and David's prayer, "Blessed be thou, Yahweh Elohim of Israel." Now, by the way, Yahweh Elohim of Israel, what would you say that's a contraction of? What thinkest thou? That's right. Thou that art the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, and the Elohim of Jacob. Let me just stop for a minute and ask a question of the recording brother at the back of the hall. Could you just mention our discussion yesterday concerning Jacob for a moment? So when we talked about this afterwards, Jacob's name was changed to Israel, and so when we come through the text, you'll find sometimes it's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and sometimes it's the God of Israel. What we discussed this yesterday is that Israel was a wider term than Jacob, wasn't it? Because, by the way, what does Jacob always represent? Anyone know? Without fail. What does Jacob always represent in Scripture? The natural seed. The natural seed of Israel. Jacob always represents the natural seed. What does the word Israel represent, Jacob's new name? Israel, as a term, could be the natural seed, the nation of Israel, but it could also be, what else? The spiritual seed. This could be the sand of the sea and the stars of the sky for multitude. So the word Israel embraces the multitude that in fact is wider and deeper and larger than simply the natural seed. And not just the Jewish seed, but the Gentile seed. The multitude of Jew and Gentile are all embraced in the word Israel. So in fact, the change of name that Jacob receives broadens the idea of the multitudinous seed out even further, doesn't it? It begins with the 12 patriarchs that Jacob begets. But his change of name to Israel shows that he is the beginning, the progenitor of a multitudinous seed that will embrace both Jew and Gentile. So when David stands up in the first of Chronicles chapter 29 and says, David said, "Blessed be thou Yahweh Elohim of Israel," he's really summarizing the whole of the title out of Exodus chapter 3, isn't he? And now look what he says. "O Yahweh Elohim of Israel, our Father," he says. Well, there it is. Our Father. So if you hear a brother in the meeting stand up and say, "O Yahweh, our Father," that's absolutely scriptural, isn't it? It's taken out of the prayer of David himself. All right, so that's interesting. But the point is that what we've tried to do there is establish that the idea of the fatherhood of God was already implicit in the Old Testament before we come to New Testament teaching. It was already there, the teaching of that idea. But Yahweh's intention as a father was much more specific than that. God wanted a special family. God wanted a specific family that would in fact be his own unique offspring in some special way. And that brings us back to Exodus chapter 3 to our reading. You remember that we started with this yesterday in terms of Yahweh the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. Let's just come back now to the balance of what it says about the divine name and just work some ideas through now concerning the idea of Yahweh as a father. And by the way, you'll notice that Des read it correctly, because when he got to verse 14, God said unto Moses, "I am that I am." Des read it, "I will be who I will be." And that is correct, by the way, because let me just give you the details concerning that. First of all, who's got that marked into their Bibles? "I will be who I will be." Who's got that actually marked in? All right. If I said to you, how would you prove that? Have you got anything in your margin to prove it? Yes? Ayah, Asher, Ayah are the Hebrew words, correct? But prove to me that they are, I will be who I will be. Have you got any comments in the margin about that? Yes? Verse 12. What about verse 12? Excellent. It is too. So verse 12, when it says, certainly I will be with thee, that's the word ayah in the Hebrew. So I will be, verse 12, is the very same word in the Hebrew translated I am, verse 14. And clearly I will be is the preferred translation. And for this reason as well, I've got a note here that says that out of over 40 occurrences of the word ayah, apart from Exodus chapter 3, only once elsewhere is it rendered I am. 27 times out of 40 it's translated I will be, and every other time it's translated will I be, I shall be, I be, in the sense of a whole series of words like that, but never, apart from one other occasion, I am, which leads us to the conclusion that I am is not the main meaning of ayah at all. And it fits completely naturally in the context of verse 12 that it's I will be with thee. It's anyone else know anything about ayah? Yes. Who was and is to come. Yeah, I've heard that, but my understanding of the word ayah is that it's in the first person singular, imperfect. And the imperfect tense in the Hebrew is an uncompleted tense and therefore relates to the future. Now, it may relate to the past and to the present as well, but my understanding was that the imperfect tense pointed to the future. But that's the force of the imperfect tense in the Hebrew. Now, someone else may know more about Hebrew than me, because I don't claim to be a Hebrew scholar. But certainly, that's the justification for why it's most consistently translated, I will be, 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 most of the times it's used. Because the imperfect tense says it's something in the future. Now, what's interesting about these words is, and I haven't got a screen for this, so let me just put this up. And you'll probably know this, but if you haven't got this in your margin, I think it's worth having, and that's this. So what we've got is ayah, Asher ayah. Now, the thing with ayah is that ayah is first person, singular, future. But Asher is singular and plural and masculine and feminine. So this is singular. I will be. I will be. But Asher is plural. That's better. Can you all see that now? As well as can be expected. So Asher is singular and plural, masculine and feminine. So what the phrase says in Exodus chapter 3 is, I will be who, and this is the, if you like, the group through whom God will reveal himself, who I will be. Now what's marvellous about that is that this is singular, meaning it's God. But what clearly does this tell us about this word here? What can it represent? What must it represent? It must represent a multitude. And the very word that's chosen in the Hebrew is telling us that it's a multitude. It can be masculine. It can be feminine. It can be singular. It can be plural. It can be all of those things. It represents a multitude. So I will be personal, singular, future, God's intention, who, multitudinous, I will be. I'm going to be revealed in a multitude in the future. That's simple, really, isn't it? I am going to be revealed in a multitude in the future is the essential idea of the phrase. So one other question, and I don't know if you can see this far down. So why does it change to Yahweh from Aya? Does anyone know why? It's Aya in verse 14, Aya Asher Aya, and then Yahweh Elohim hath sent me. Why does it change from Aya to Yahweh? Does anybody know? Yes?
It's a different person speaking. Yahweh is he who will be.
Yes?
When you're referring to somebody else, you use he rather than I.
We can't talk to God and say, I will be. It's he who will be when we're referring to God. And in fact, Aya is the verb and Yahweh is the noun. It's the verb and the noun form of the same Hebrew word. So when we're referring to the idea or when we're speaking to God, obviously the verb or the noun are appropriate in different contexts, but it's the same word. So if you've ever wondered why it changes from Yahweh to Aya, don't worry, it's the same word and is conveying, in effect, the same meaning. So here's God's intention to reveal himself in a multitudinous seed, which really, I'm suggesting, is God being a father. This is the fatherhood of God. God says, I want a family. And I know I'm the father of all the creation, in some general sense, but I want much more than that, says God. I want a family who are my children, specifically my children. And I think that all of that intention of God to have a particular family that he could call his very own, that multitude that belonged to him specially, was Yahweh's intention from the very beginning, and all connected with the idea and the use of the Yahweh name and the idea here of he who will be revealed in that multitude of mighty ones. So Brother Thomas puts it this way in Phanerosis, which sounds a bit hard when you first listen to it, but it's well worth thinking through. One of the benefits of Brother Thomas, actually there's several benefits to Brother Thomas, aren't there? The first thing is that Brother Thomas launches us successfully out of pidgin English and text messaging vocabulary into decent words and useful language. And by the way, I'm not joking. You know, we just had a brother and sister come back from Bougainville in our area. They speak pidgin English in Bougainville. There are many brothers and sisters there. They love the truth. They're enthusiastic. When it came to try and discuss the great things of Yahweh's purpose, they were absolutely flummoxed. They probably haven't got the word flummoxed, by the way, in Bougainvillean pidgin English. They haven't got the word flabbergasted either. But you see, they couldn't understand what we were trying to teach them, or what our brother and sister were trying to teach them, because they didn't have the words. And if you haven't got the words, you haven't got the thoughts. You see, language is the vehicle by which thoughts are expressed. If you only have pidgin English language, guess what sort of thoughts you have? Pidgin English thoughts. So if you want to soar into the vastness of Yahweh's purpose, you actually need some decent, halfway decent grasp of language. And by the way, in case you think I'm exaggerating, it's my personal belief, and it's shared by a number of people, is it was in the providence of God that the truth was rediscovered in the English language to facilitate the spread of that gospel message in a language so capable of nuance and subtlety and shading of light and colour and texture and thought and detail as to be beyond most other languages. And the English language brought all of these facilities together that the truth might be expressed in all of its wonder and grandeur and greatness and majesty. So if you're going to be a serious Bible scholar, there's no better thing you can do than to pick up your vocabulary a pace or two and start learning some decent language, because language is the channel of thoughts. Matt, you were going to say something?
That's right.
And guess what? Lots of brothers and sisters have done that for many generations. I can remember Elvis Israel classes when I was a boy and the class would stop and they'd say, what's that word? I can remember a marvellous thing. This is a digression, I know, but a marvellous thing. Brother Thompson's got a picture of the times and seasons of mankind. And the last circle, remember this, the last circle is the 1,000 years of the kingdom. He's got the antediluvian epoch, and he's got all these circles coming through history. And the last circle is 1,000 years. And on the end of the circle, he's got a little blip. And that blip is the little season of Revelation chapter 20, when the final rebellion takes place. Brother Thomas was suggesting that it might poke out beyond the 1,000 years, rather than be inside the 1,000 years. But he doesn't call it a blip, he calls it a crescentical prefix. A crescentical prefix. Which, by the way, if you look it up, you think, that's quite an elegant description for the little blip on the end of that circle. So now you've learnt something. You've learnt something about language. And lots of brothers and sisters who didn't have a lot of learning read Opus Israel and in fact became quite learned people themselves for their day and generation because they learnt to understand vocabulary. This is what Brother Thomas says. Let me stop digressing. And now I can't find the bit that I want. After all that dramatic lead-up, okay. With reference to this, Elohim said to Moses, i.e. they who delivered the words of the Spirit, the Eternal Spirit sent them to say for him, I will be who I will be. Tell Israel, I will be has sent me, Moses, unto you. I will be the mighty ones of your fathers, the mighty ones of Abram, the mighty ones of Isaac, and the mighty ones of Jacob. This is my name for an olam, and this my memorial for a generation of the race. Now, by the way, if you were alert, and you were a Bible scholar, you would have gone, zing! That's not what my AV says in Exodus chapter 3, which we did for the reading today, and you'd be onto that like a rocket to say, that's Brother Thomas's translation of that verse. Did you notice that? Did you pick that up straight away? Got to have your antenna up to pick it up. I'll come back to that because it's a very good translation. The memorial in its simplest form, he says, is Aya Asha Aya, I will be who I will be. Asha, who, the relative pronoun in this memorial, is both singular and plural, masculine and feminine. It will therefore stand for 10,000 times 10,000, as well as for two or three persons. The other two words of the memorial are the first person singular future tense of the verb haya, to be. Now this is the bit you've got to really stop and scratch your head over. In this memorial, the Eternal Spirit is the I, and the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob are the who, of whom it is memorialized that they shall be. Or, although who refers to a plurality, that has been developed. Now, by the way, that took me more than one reading to get that myself, but Brother Thomas stretches your mind as well as your language, but by the time you finish that, you think, that's actually a really profound thought about what Exodus 3 is going on and talking about. But if we were really to make this simple, what I would say is that Aya Asha Aya is about Yahweh's intention as a father to manifest himself in a special multitude that are exclusively his family. Yes, it is. Page 60 and 61. So this is what he goes on to say. This is what Moses goes on to say in verse 15. He says, God said to Moses, you say to the children of Israel, Yahweh Elohim of your fathers, the God of Abram, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob have sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. Now, did you pick up that translation from Brother Thomas? Who's got it in their margin? Hands up those who have got Brother Thomas in their margin. Right, let me write it out to you, or read it out to you, because it's a very good translation to have in the margin of your Bible in Exodus chapter 3. I'll just double check those words. Yeah, so actually for this particular translation, it's page 59. Page 59. So this is what he says. You see where it says in the authorized version, this is my name. This is how Brother Thomas translates it from now, from that point on. This is my name for an olam. By the way, does anyone know what olam means?
It doesn't just mean forever. In fact, it doesn't specifically mean forever at all. What does it mean? For a hidden period. This is my name for an olam. This my memorial unto a generation of the race. Ooh, now did you notice that? Unto a generation of the race. Now you think, now how did Brother Thomas get that out of the AV? This my memorial for an olam, that's easy, for the hidden period. Whatever period God has in mind, this name is going to memorialize his purpose, his intention to be a father of a family. And he said, this is my memorial unto a generation of the race. Now let me tell you why Brother Thomas says that. The word in the Hebrew of Exodus chapter 3 verse 15, that literal phrase at the end, unto all generations, in the Hebrew it's actually unto generation of generation. That's the literal Hebrew. Unto generation of generation. But what Brother Thomas did is he took the second word generation and he said, no, it's actually a race. Instead of saying unto a generation of generation, he said unto a generation of the race. So he changed the second word generation and said it's the race. And by the way, that's a good translation for a reason which I'll come to in a minute. By the way, the word generation in the Hebrew stands for a circle. And the idea of a circle is that, you see, you start your life, you go around this long and complicated and difficult and unique circle that no one else has ever been through before in their life but you. And when you get to the end of the circle, it's all over. But hopefully by that stage you've had a son who starts another circle, and he goes around a circle, and by the time he dies he's had a son who begins another circle, and a circle stands for a generation of time, a generation of a person's life. So you see, a generation of generation means you could, it's been translated in other places, unto generation, from generation unto generation. Or unto all generations, as the AV says here. But Brother Thomas says, no. It's a generation of the race. Now, why did Brother Thomas say that? Well, let me give you three references to take a note of as to why I think he said that. Because Brother Thomas realized that this wasn't just God's name to all generations of mankind. This name of God was a prophecy of his intention with only one generation. Only one specific generation. It's the only generation that God's interested in out of the whole of humanity. Just one. So what generation do you think that is? You tell me. Yes. In other words, this is the special generation of the saints who are taken out for God's name over the period of all generations of time. But out of all the generations of time, one single generation is extracted by God, two there, five there, a multitude there, ten there, some there, all through time, out of all the generations, one single generation is extracted by God. This is the special generation of the saints. Or if I could put it another way, it's the generation of the multitude, Asher. And that generation is God's special family, whom he has fathered. And that's the only generation that God's interested in. Now let me show you a couple of cross-references about that generation. Come to Psalm 22. I think Brother Thomas was absolutely spot on when he gave that translation, because Brother Thomas understood the spirit of what the Yahweh name and what the prophecy of Exodus chapter 3 was all about. So this is what he says. Psalm 22. Verse 30. A seed shall serve him. And that seed that serves him shall be accounted to Yahweh for a generation. Now the seed that serves God doesn't belong to any one generation of time. The seed that serves God are the seed that have been begotten by him as a father, and they serve him. And they span all generations of time, but they only count as one generation as far as God's concerned. These ones are the generation of the race that Brother Thomas refers to. That seed, when Christ comes and the kingdom is established, verse 28, the kingdom of Yahweh's, he's the governor among the nations, when all that epoch of time comes, this particular special seed shall be accounted to Yahweh for a generation. Again, Psalm 24 on the same page on the other side. Do you remember this phrase? It's the ones who ascend into the hill of Yahweh, verse 3, who stand in his holy place, who have clean hands and a pure heart, verse 4, who have not lifted up their soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully. These ones shall receive the blessing from Yahweh and righteousness from the God of his salvation. This is the generation of them that seek him, that seek thy face, O God of Jacob, says the margin. This is that generation. It's only one generation. It's the generation of the saints. The generation of the multitude through whom God will be revealed and manifested. So when Brother Thomas translated that, this is my memorial, this is my name for an olam, and this my memorial unto a generation of the race. I think this is the generation he was thinking of. The generation referred to in these Psalms and other places. Now, by the way, if I was going to ask you this question, what would you answer? What does the word generation even convey to you as an idea, as a word? Generation. I'll rephrase my question. In its verb form.
Children.
Very good. And notice that that came from a man of Lismore. If anyone knows the meaning of the word generation, to generate, as in the word to generate offspring, it's a man of Lismore. Yet to be proved, of course, but intellectually he knows the truth of this, if not yet experientially. But he has many fine examples to follow, in particular ecclesia that he comes from. Generation, it's an the idea is of the offspring of a father, isn't it? To generate offspring. This is Yahweh's generation. He's a father. It's the fatherhood of God that's implicit in this idea. Come back to Exodus chapter 3. Just one more thing in terms of what he says. So verse 14, God said to Moses, I will be who I will be. And he said, you go and say to the children of Israel, I will be hath sent me. I am Yahweh Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, the Elohim of Jacob. He's the one that sent me unto you. This is my name for the hidden period of my purpose, and this my memorial unto the generation of the race. Now, this word memorial, we just want to have a look at the word memorial as well. This is my memorial unto the generation of the race. So what does the idea of the word memorial relate to? Well, the word memorial in the Hebrew, zikr, comes from zakar, to mark so as to recognize. To mark something so as to recognize it. And by the way, why that's interesting is this is the very first time in the Bible that the word occurs. The zakar memorial. Something you mark so that you can recognize it. Now, by the way, the word memorial here is paralleled with something else. What's it paralleled with in Exodus chapter 3?
Name.
This is my name unto the hidden period, and this is my memorial unto the generation of the race. So, by the way, what's Olam paralleled with? The generation of the race. So what's Yahweh's hidden period? The time required for the full development and completion of the generation of the race. Wouldn't that be right? Now God says, that name that I've given you is actually my memorial. I want you to mark it so as to recognize it. And the generation of the race, wherever they've been throughout their lives, are the ones who have marked that name, and they recognize it everywhere. The generation of the race know how to mark out the meaning of the name. They spot it everywhere. We're going to come back to this in our last study, by the way. I'm going to ask you how we actually make this a memorial in the generation of the race, in our own day and age. And I'm going to tell you why I think the marker is disappearing and what we've got to do to bring the marker back. Because the generation of the race are those who, above all people, know how to mark out Yahweh's name and purpose so as to recognize it wherever they see it. Now let me show you how these two ideas are connected in the scriptures. Name and memorial. Now have a look at this. Job chapter 18. So if you want a line in your mind map, the line is name / memorial, Exodus 3 verse 15. So now we're going to trace out a set of references to the significance of that idea. Job 18 and verse 17. Notice how these two ideas are brought together quite consistently. And then when we've looked at these references, I'm going to ask you what you think they symbolize in terms of Exodus chapter 3. So Job 18, verse 17, his zikar, his memorial, shall perish from the earth, and he shall have no name in the street. All right, here's another one, Psalm 9. Psalm 9, verses 5 and 6. Psalm 9 says, "Thou hast rebuked the heathen, thou hast destroyed the wicked, thou hast put out their name forever and ever, and thou, enemy destructions, have come to a perpetual end, and thou hast destroyed cities, their memorial is perished with them." A name's put out, verse 5, a memorial is perished, verse 6. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 7. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 7. Says, "The memory of the just, the memorial of the just is blessed, but the name of the wicked shall rot." Memorial and name. Psalm 135. So Psalm 135 says, in verse 13, and by the way, the margin says, this probably comes from Exodus chapter 3, "Thy name, O Yahweh, endureth forever, and thy memorial, O Yahweh, throughout all generations," which by the expression in the margin, "to generation and generation." That'll be the same phrase as Exodus chapter 3, yes.
It reads like
parallelism.
Yes.
No, what I'm saying is that clearly the idea of the name and the memorial are linked. So I'll come to that in a minute. So let me just give you one more cross-reference. Let's say Isaiah chapter 26 and verse 8. And then I'm going to ask you a question about the significance of this little set of references. So Isaiah 26 says, in verse 8, "Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee. The desire of our soul is to thy name and to the memorial of thee." So Rotherham translates the second part of verse 8, "Yea, in the way of thy judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for thee." And then Rotherham says, "Unto thy name and unto thy memorial was there a longing of soul." Unto thy name and unto thy memorial was there a longing of soul. So let me ask you a question now. First of all, what do you think is the significance of the parallel between memorial and name?
What conclusion would you draw from that? What significance do you think? Sorry?
A memorable name.
Oh, very good. A memorable name, yes. Now, just tease that out a little bit for me. Why would name and memorial be parallel terms?
They're talking about the name is the mark there.
Yeah, yeah.
The name, you would remember the
purpose. Every time you use the name, you would memorialise the purpose, yes? 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 You remember people's names. We certainly hope we remember this one. Not everyone remembers people's names, or not everyone remembers everyone's name. But certainly the use of a name is part of how we memorialise it. There's something more than that, though, obviously, with this, isn't there? It's not just a case of saying, well, we remembered his name was Yahweh. So what? Is that the memorial? Just that the name is Yahweh? Yes? Ah, now we're getting onto it. Yes? Yes, all of the above. So in Yahweh's case, the fullness of his name is a memorial of his intention, of his purpose, of his prophetic word. It's a memorial of his whole desire. It's not just, oh, I remember that chap's name is Bob. This name, more than just a name. My name is Roger. By the way, I was called Michael by my parents. And my grandfather came from Scotland. And when I was called Michael, which would have been quite a nice name, by the way, he turned to my father and he said, no grandson of mine's going to be called by a Catholic name, because in Scotland, Catholics were called Mickey Doos. And he didn't want a grandson with a Catholic name. And by the way, the fact that it was relatively Hebrew must have eluded him, so I got changed from Michael, which is thoroughly Hebraistic, to Roger, which is as boring as it comes. But it doesn't memorialise anything particularly, does it? But Yahweh's name does. There's a prophecy hidden inside that name. And by the way, there's another thing too. Isn't there a verse that says something about the fact that a person's name stands for their... What is it? A good name and a good reputation, isn't it? So a person's name is indicative of their whole character and reputation. Well, Yahweh's name is supreme in this regard. Now, let me ask you the second question. So if God's name is a memorial of his character, of his purpose, of his intention, of his greatness, of his fatherhood, who on earth in all the world would be interested in marking out that name so as never to forget it? Who would be interested in doing that? You tell me. Logically. Who would be the most interested in that name?
The Son.
The Son and the Father. Is that logical? I'll give you an illustration from my own family. I have two older sisters. When my first older sister Vivian was born, Grandpa Lewis came to my father and he said, "What's the babe?"
My dad said,
"It's a daughter. We called her Vivian." And Grandpa said, "Och, that's nice." And then when the second child was born in the household, my grandfather came to my father, he says, "What's the child?" And Dad said, "It's another wee girl, Dad. We've called her Susan." And Grandfather Lewis said, "Och, that's nice." And when the third child was born, Grandfather Lewis came and says, "What's the child?" And my father said to him, "It's a little boy. It's a little boy, Dad." And Grandfather Lewis simply said, "A son." Now, there was a story behind that, because my father was an only child, and his father was an only child, and his father was an only child. And for three generations, the house of Lewis hung in the balance by the slender thread of one wee lad, generation to generation. And if he hadn't had something, some offspring, the name would be lost. But each of them in three generations had one son, fortunately a son, that the name Lewis might continue. And my grandfather was just completely overcome that it was a little boy. And I rose to the challenge and said, I shall have three sons, and memorialise the name Lewis that it might never be lost. See, it's the significance. You see, the only people interested in the Lewis name are Lewis's. You couldn't care less about the Lewis name yourself. So who marks out the Yahweh name so that it's recognised everywhere? His sons. Why? Because that's our name. That's our family name. We want to preserve and memorialise that name. That belongs to our dad. That's the significance. There's a moral significance of that in our last study to say, what's going on in the brotherhood now concerning the Yahweh name and the generation of the race who are so attached to that name as Yahweh's own children that they mark it out so as to see it everywhere and to recognize it and to memorialize it? That's the challenge. So let me close with a couple of slides now that just summarize what we've looked at least in measure today, out of this particular section. So, Yahweh manifested as a father. This is an extract, again, from Phanerosis, page 48. The father is embodied power. Paternal power implies offspring or children. Children or sons of power. It is power emanating from the father, corporealized in one or in a multitude. What does the word corporealized mean? English word for the day. Corporealized?
Made physical,
given a bodily form, given substance. It's power emanating from the Father, given bodily form in one or in a multitude. Notice that, in one, Yitzhak, or in a multitude, Yaakov, but never separated or detached from the focal center, Abraham, the Father. The Son power is therefore the Father power, multitudinously expressed and manifested through many bodies. So Brother Thomas's writings here are about the fatherhood of God as expressed in his name and his intention to be revealed in those offspring that come from him. Now here's the logic of what we've said today. And to me, by the way, I think what's happened in the brotherhood, it's actually happened with more than one manifestation. There's, in the end, it becomes a cliche, doesn't it? God manifestation. What's that about? Well, this is why we've chosen to perhaps unfold this particular thing, because, well, I think this is what it is in its simplest form. The term Father, when applied to Yahweh, is highly expressive of his intention to create offspring who are his children. Because they are his sons, they reveal the family characteristics of the Father, for they are like him. This is the essence of God manifestation. His children, by their demeanor and speech and attitude, reflect their origin and can therefore be recognized as belonging to his family. We have been created in the image and likeness of God. It was the intention of Yahweh from the beginning, therefore, to populate the earth with his own family who look and think and act like him. That's God manifestation. Do you belong to his family? Then everyone should know. Because you know your father's name, and you look like him, and you think like him, and you act like him. Now, by the way, the looking like him won't be fulfilled until we're given divine nature. But God says, I'll give you the physical immortality if you think and act like me now. That's God manifestation. Now, let me give you an illustration. I feel sorry to have to do this, but in the room I can instantly see. There's a lad down here with a yellow shirt on, yellow t-shirt. He's got Mansfield stamped all over him, hasn't he? You just know that he's a Mansfield. I mean, you can tell just from the tousled hair and the probing questions, and when he stands and speaks, you think he is a Mansfield. You see, there are family characteristics. There's no mix-up at the hospital with this boy, was there? He definitely belongs to that generation of the race. Well, so should God's family. God manifestation means that wherever the saints are walking in the earth, people should say, that man, that woman,
They are the offspring of God. And you can tell by how they act, how they dress, how they speak. They're the offspring of God.
He's going to be a father. That's what he wants. That's what this is all about. Yes, ma'am. That's right. That's right. Exactly.
It says in the New Testament, doesn't it, that they took note that certain people had been with... You know what it says? They'd been with Jesus. They'd been affected. Well, we've got to be affected by contact with the Father. And if you know to behave and look and act like the Father, then you've understood the secret of God manifestation. It's as simple as that. That's what this is all about. Here endeth the lesson.